Welcome to International Edition. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington. Ahead, an analyst considers the deadly attack in Pakistan, optimism about the prospects of restoration in Palmyra, an experimental robot to help unlock the mysteries of delicate marine life.
Well, I really like this little robot. This robot can operate under the intense pressure that dramatically increases as it goes deeper into the sea.
And we hear the backstory on Bob Dylan's influence on country music, coming up right here on The Voice of America. The Pakistani province of Punjab, the power base of Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif, is observing 3 days of mourning after a suicide bomber killed or maimed hundreds of people, mostly women and children, at a park in the eastern city of Lahore. A Pakistani military spokesman said the killers must be brought to justice. A Pakistani Taliban faction known as Jamaat-ul-Ahrar claimed responsibility for Sunday's attack that killed at least 70 people and wounded 300 others. A spokesman said the attack was aimed at Christians and more such attacks will occur. Regional analyst Alam Payind of Ohio State University told VOA's Victor Beatty, this Pakistani Taliban faction has a history of attacking security forces as well as Western targets and religious minority groups.
This Taliban group are targeting not only the Christians, they're targeting Hindus. Some of Hindus are living in Pakistan. And also they are targeting the Shiites. So this is a group that has been condemned by the Pakistani government and all Muslim-majority countries.
A spokesman for one of these groups said, our suicide bombers will continue these attacks, I presume, against minorities, especially Christians.
I think the majority of the people that this group has targeted were the military officers and the military school. If you remember that about 14, 15 months ago, they targeted one of the schools that were the military officers. So their fight is with the Pakistani government and the Pakistani military. And it is a revenge that because the Pakistani government is bombarding the positions of this Pakistani Taliban in northwest frontier and also sometimes even inside the Afghan territory, Afghanistan. So there is a hot war going on between the Taliban and the Pakistani government, but they are just now attacking these other minority groups as well.
Well, this is the most horrific attack against civilians in Pakistan so far this year. The United States issued a statement saying it stands with the people and government of Pakistan at this difficult hour. We'll continue to work with our partners in Pakistan and across the region to root out the scourge of terrorism. What might that mean?
The United States is sharing intelligence, and there is a networking between the United States government and the European governments, and also all of these in Pakistan, in Afghanistan, and in Iraq and other countries. So they are sharing this intelligence against these groups, which are really have become dangerous groups, all of them. Well, it used to be Al-Qaeda, and Al-Qaeda is almost, this was after the Soviet Union invasion of Afghanistan. That invasion gave some sort of rise to the Al-Qaeda and Taliban, Afghan Taliban. And then the American troops going to Iraq, this ISIS, which was the Islamic State of Iraq, and then the Syrian Sunnis got together with the, it evolved in from ISIS to ISIL, which is the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria. So they are becoming a danger not only to outsiders, Europeans and Americans and Israel. So they are a danger against their own people.
And Alan Payne says such attacks should underscore the risks to Pakistan for providing safe haven to terrorist groups that operate in neighboring Afghanistan. Joining me with what is being said on social media about this story is social media reporter Andrew Palchevsky. Welcome, Andrew.
Thank you very much. Good to be here. Well, a lot of people talking about this on social media, of course, and comparing it to the recent Brussels attack, and a lot of people on social media expressing their concern or their unhappiness that the Brussels attack received so much attention and this attack didn't. And they're saying there's kind of this, it's not consistent, I guess is what they're saying. They're saying, well, we had more people that died in this attack in Lahore. Why isn't it getting as much coverage? They're saying there's a bias towards the West.
We were talking about this when the Paris attacks happened.
Exactly. And this happens every time, unfortunately, we see a series of these attacks. If there's some in the West and some in the Middle East or elsewhere in Asia, there's always, people say, kind of this discrepancy between which is getting covered more. So that's being expressed on social media this morning. People also unhappy with Facebook this morning because of their safety check feature. Now, we've talked about this on the show previously, that Facebook has activated the safety check in natural disasters or terrorist attacks to tell people within the area, are you all right? Can you check in? If you can, we'll notify your friends and family that you're okay.
Well, why are people unhappy with that?
Well, they're unhappy because Facebook, for some reason, accidentally sent this safety check feature out to many people all over the world, not just in Lahore. Usually it's just isolated to the area where this event takes place. And so people were getting notifications saying, are you near this bombing in Lahore, Pakistan? And they're saying, no, that's not correct. Some people were even getting text messages that were saying, are you near the explosion? Let us know. And they had no idea where this was coming from. They hadn't heard about the explosion yet, so they were very concerned. They said, oh my gosh, is there an explosion in my city? So Facebook has had to come out and apologize, saying that they made a mistake in sending that out to too many people. It's a great idea, and as we've talked about on the show in the past, great in practice, allowing people to check in and notify their family and friends, especially when maybe cell phone networks are down. But in this case, it just didn't work, and they have to apologize for that.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Andrew, for stopping by.
Thank you.
This is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
In a number of studies, researchers have outlined the health dangers of sitting too much and its link to the onset of some chronic diseases and early death. Now, a new report in the American Journal of Preventive Medicine suggests sitting for more than 3 hours a day is to blame for 3.8% of all worldwide deaths. The study authors also found that moderate or even vigorous physical exercise might not be enough to offset the negative effects of sitting for too long. They suggest that reducing daily sitting time to less than 3 hours a day could add an average of 0.2 years to a person's life expectancy. The researchers say the link between sitting and death was highest in Western Pacific nations, followed by European, Eastern Mediterranean, American, and then Southeast Asian countries. Lately, more office workers are using workstations that allow them to alternate between sitting and standing throughout the day. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The fall of the ancient World Heritage City of Palmyra to Russian-backed Syrian government forces and Lebanese Hezbollah militia Sunday is the latest setback to befall the Islamic State. It has sustained losses in northern Syria at the hands of Kurdish fighters. Its leadership has been decimated by U.S.-led airstrikes, and it has been forced out of the western Iraqi city of Ramadi. The IS group captured Palmyra last May, and the extent of the damage the occupiers carried out on its famous monuments, temples, and underground tombs is unclear. But archaeologists have been dispatched to assess the damage. Speaking Sunday in Amman, Jordan, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon expressed hope antiquity experts would be able to repair the damage done during the IS occupation.
We are encouraged and fortunate that Syrian government forces have been able to defeat the ISIS from Palmyra and is now able to preserve and protect these human common asset, cultural asset. And I'm also encouraged by the announcement that they will try to not only preserve and protect, they'll try to restore. I hope they will be able to do that.
The head of Syria's antiquities said most restoration work could be completed by year's end, and he said Damascus would undertake strong precautionary measures to ensure the city doesn't fall to the IS group again. Middle East expert Peter Bechtold of Portland State University in Oregon says he is encouraged about the prospects of restoration.
I think so. I mean, from what I'm looking at right now, there are about seven or eight pictures. It shows most of the columns are standing upright. And in the museum, there are some very interesting artifacts which also seem to be fine. On the other hand, there is inscribed in Arabic, it is forbidden by the emir to come in here. Who knows who did this? It could have been the ISIL people or it could have been somebody else. There's an area that is clearly damaged. But, you know, not far away is Baalbek in eastern Lebanon, and I've been there, and a lot of that was destroyed over history, and it is still worth visiting. And if you consider the artifacts in Egypt that have been destroyed over the centuries and have been rebuilt after the Napoleonic invasions, So it is possible to recover that from a world culture point of view.
We asked what effect the retaking of Palmyra will have on the Russian-backed government forces.
Well, it will give a boost to the government supporters for sure. That is to say, the people in the westernmost part of the country, the mountainous region between the Mediterranean and Latakia, Tartus on the west, and Homs, Hamas, Damascus in that area in the northwest. However, leaders of the opposition said they do not agree with that assessment, that they think that the government is just as bad as ISIS, and they're opposed to both. And they allegedly represent the Syrian Sunni opposition to the government.
It appears the cessation of hostilities in Syria may be a plus for both the government and Moscow.
Relatively speaking, that is correct, because nearly everyone agrees that the introduction of Russian fighter jets and helicopters and some on-the-ground units has helped the Syrian army. However, the Sunnis in opposition to the government are also in opposition to the Russians. And so they need to receive assurances that they have a regional government, at least to what the Kurds have been getting in northern Iraq, that is very much autonomous. If we can get that, I can see an overall settlement, and then everybody can claim victory.
In a U.S. television appearance Sunday, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry reiterated that the Syrian conflict cannot end until President Bashar al-Assad leaves power. Coming up on International Edition, squishy fingers squeezing deep in the sea, and Bob Dylan meeting up with Johnny Cash. An experimental robot with a gentle touch is helping scientists unlock the mysteries of delicate marine life. Known as squishy fingers, the undersea machine can gently collect samples in deep water at depths way beyond the reach of human divers. VOA's Deborah Block joins us on the line. Hi there, Deborah.
Hi, Susan.
Well, what's this all about?
Well, I really like this little robot. This robot can operate under the intense pressure that dramatically increases as it goes deeper into the sea. In fact, it's been tried out in more than 150 meters, which is very deep, to collect samples on the reefs. It has these supple grippers that kind of remind me of a moving caterpillar or the soft tentacles of a sea creature. And this device can take the fragile coral samples without breaking them or hurting the rest of the ecosystem. Another advantage is that this robot can get into these little burrows where some sea creatures live. Well, a team of researchers at the Wyss Institute of Harvard University, they've been developing two kinds of soft robotic grippers that are designed to pick up objects of different shapes and sizes. And what I thought was really interesting is the grippers were tested in a laboratory using different kinds of vegetables, believe it or not, like lettuce.
Well, what kind of information do the scientists hope to collect other than garden greens for a salad?
Yes, that's for sure. I think they're hoping for a whole lot more. Well, you know, the scientists control this robot from a boat, you know, using a joystick, so they can... And so from there, they can actually see the samples it's collecting through a live video feed connected to the device. So, of course, they're hoping to get a close-up look at the specimens. They want to measure them, collect genetic data, and perhaps find some new sea creature, Susan, we have never seen before.
I like the name, but why squishy fingers?
I think there's a good reason for that. The grippers are mostly made from memory foam, which gives them their flexibility. Now, with this memory foam, when you squeeze it a little bit, you feel some pressure. But if you keep squeezing it, the pressure doesn't change. So this means the material won't be affected by the intense underwater pressure like a lot of other materials. But there are also plans to embed sensors on the grippers so the specimens do not have to be removed from the sea. And the scientists hope to add a tactile response to the grippers so that the person that's controlling the robot can actually feel what it's touching. Wouldn't that be amazing?
It would be amazing, especially if it touches something we've never seen before.
That's right.
I've seen pictures of when they brought up some samples from very deep in the ocean, and they come through the different pressures, and by the time they get to the boat, they're just mush. And this will help them see things that they can't see up here on the surface with the different atmospheric depths.
That's right. This is absolutely amazing.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Deborah. You're always interesting.
Thank you, Susan.
Bye-bye now.
Bye-bye.
This is VOA.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA podcasts a try.
VOANews.com.
Visit our website at VOANews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
I'm Millar Sega, host of VOA's The Correspondents, a weekly roundup of the top stories with analysis from our dedicated reporters around the globe.
Among the stars expressing support, Frida Pinto.
This is a problem that inflicts almost every country.
Think of it as a conversation on the biggest issues of the day. Wherever the news may be, our correspondents are there. Listen to The Correspondents, Saturdays and Sundays on VOA.
Dylan's influence on popular music crossed multiple genres. His impact on country music, in particular, is being celebrated in an exhibit at the Country Music Hall of Fame called Dylan, Cash, and the Nashville Cats. Nikki Strong of VOA Music spoke with International Edition's Sarah Williams.
Nikki, tell us about Bob Dylan's role in country music.
Okay, well, before Bob Dylan went to Nashville to record, the place was really perceived as being conservative, a southern town, definitely not on the cutting edge of music. And that all changed when Bob Dylan bucked his record label and decided to record there. It opened doors for a slew of other prominent folk rock and pop artists at the time, such as Joan Baez and Paul McCartney and Neil Young, to also visit Nashville to record. And it helped foster a cultural exchange between all of those genres. And because of the high caliber of talent and skill and musicianship of the local session musicians that were there, which were called the Nashville Cats in this exhibit, so to speak, Nashville, or Music City, as they call it now, became a highly respected destination spot to make great music. And it is also this connection that helped make Dylan a major force in the creation of the country rock genre.
What brought Dylan to Nashville?
Okay, so this is the backstory. Dylan was recording with producer Bob Johnston in New York. And Bob Johnston used to live in Nashville, and he invited Charlie McCoy to come up to visit one of Dylan's sessions. And McCoy was a well-respected multi-instrumentalist session musician in Nashville. He came up and played guitar on Dylan's song, Desolation Row. Well, Dylan was so impressed with McCoy's musicianship, so Johnston was like, hey, Bob, there's more. You know where that came from. You should go down to Nashville to record. And so Dylan did. And in February 1966, he recorded what is considered one of his greatest albums, Blonde on Blonde.
We'll talk about his relationship with Johnny Cash.
Okay, so he and Johnny Cash, the two really bonded at the 1964 Newport Folk Festival. And they met up in Nashville in February of 1969. Dylan had recorded most of Nashville Skyline at that time when he went into the studio with Cash, and then they cut several duets. One is called Girl from the North Country, and that appeared on Nashville Skyline, and Cash wrote the Grammy-winning liner notes for the album. The exhibit in particular also focuses on how the Johnny Cash show also helped usher in a new era of country music by featuring artists of various genres as well, especially those of the country folk tradition. And Bob Dylan was one of its very first guests. Others include Linda Ronstadt and Joni Mitchell and Kris Kristofferson and Merle Haggard. The list goes on and on.
So Dylan Cash and the Nashville Cats, that's the name of the exhibit. The Nashville Cats were the talented session musicians who helped bring the music of so many of these artists to life.
Exactly. So there's like 16 listening booths, and each is devoted to a Nashville Cat of the era. So it's like David Briggs, Kenny Buttry, Fred Carter, Pig Robbins, just to name a few. Each booth provides biographical information, archival photos, audio samples of the musician's signature licks on both country and rock recordings from the late 1960s. 60s and 70s. And there are all kinds of golden nuggets as well as part of the exhibit. Included, there's a manuscript in Dylan and Cash's handwriting for Wanted Man, a song that Dylan wrote for Cash in Nashville for Cash's 1969 album Johnny Cash at San Quentin. Paul McCartney's tape box for the master tapes and track sheets from his 1974 sessions in Nashville are there. There's a guitar and harmonica that Dylan used in the early 1960s. It's going to be a concert from the songs from the Blonde on Blonde album. There's guitar workshops. There's a bunch of fun stuff. And there's also a CD that you can actually purchase as part of the exhibit. You can buy it off Amazon. And the name of the CD is the same title of the exhibit. You can find out all kinds of stuff about the exhibit at countrymusichalloffame.org.
The exhibit is called Dylan Cash and the Nashville Cats. It runs until December of 2016 at the Country Music's Hall of Fame and Museum in Nashville, Tennessee. You can also hear all kinds of country music on VOA One's Country Hits USA with Nikki Strong. If you're on social media, you can reach Nikki on Facebook at VOA Music or on Twitter at VOA_music. Thanks, Nikki.
You're welcome.
The guilty undertaker sighs, the lonesome organ grinder cries, the silver saxophones say I should refuse you. The cracked bells and washed out horns blow into my face with scorn, but it's not that way, I wasn't born to lose you.
If you would like to listen to today's program again or any previous broadcast, please visit our website at voanews.com. Go to the Programs tab in the upper right-hand corner, then scroll down to International Edition. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
During the 31st regular session of the United Nations Human Rights Council in Geneva, United States delegates raised concerns regarding human rights in Syria, Iran, Burundi, South Sudan, North Korea, and China. They also highlighted abuses in several other countries. The delegates congratulated the government of Burma for taking key steps in the direction of democracy, but noted concern about continued military influence over the parliament and key ministries, abuses and discrimination against ethnic and religious minorities, and continued legal restrictions on freedoms of speech, assembly, and association. The United States led a joint statement on freedom of expression and peaceful transitions within democracies. 66 countries supported the statement, welcoming actions taken by states undergoing transitions to protect freedom of expression. The United States also supported important resolutions on the need for the protection of human rights defenders and the freedom to peacefully protest. The Council defeated an unprecedented number of hostile amendments, 31, which aimed to weaken the resolution on human rights defenders. U.S. Deputy Permanent Representative to the United Nations, Theodore Allegra, highlighted abuses in Latin America. The Venezuelan government uses detentions to suppress and punish government critics, including the political opposition, civil society, and independent media, he said. We call for the release of political prisoners and justice for those tortured and mistreated in detention. He also called on Cuba to end the practice of arbitrary short-term detention, respect freedoms of expression and assembly, and release all political prisoners. Regarding Russia, Mr. Allegra said the U.S. remains concerned about the occupation of Crimea and Russia's actions in eastern Ukraine. Domestically, the Russian government increasingly restricts freedom of expression while creating a climate of impunity for harassment and attacks against activists, journalists, and the political opposition. The promotion of human rights remains a pillar of U.S. foreign policy. The fight for greater freedom, greater respect, greater dignity is a unifying narrative of our humanity in all its diversity, Deputy Secretary of State Antony Blinken said recently. That is why we are very proud to join this council in upholding our common responsibility to this universal pursuit. The United Nations Human Rights Council celebrated its 10th anniversary this month. The United States' commitment to the mandate and mission of the Council runs deep into our nation's history, Deputy Secretary of State Blinken said in an address to the high-level segment. It is engraved into our nation's founding values and etched into the standards we strive to hold ourselves to every day.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.